Arno Michaelis, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Marco. It's always great to see you, and I appreciate being here.
Well, it's good. It's good to, always good to talk to you because you do such good work. And also now I wanted to talk to you because of what happened a month ago at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek.
Right.
Where this man, whose name I've decided I won't say,
okay,
went into the temple and shot and killed six people.
Right.
And then took his own life, although the story came out differently. Sometimes some people say that he, one police officer thought that he was shot. But now, that's a hate crime. Everybody calls it a hate crime. They identified him as a skinhead or a former skinhead. I know you identify yourself as a former skinhead.
Right.
Always makes me a little nervous when people identify people as skinheads because in my day, I was a long-haired hippie. So I keep thinking just something about that it maybe is a little, I feel, what happens to Bryan Cranston who does Breaking Bad, does he get? But anyway. But so you lived a life that's closer to where this guy was living,
right,
certainly than I did and than most people did. So what happened to him? What got him to the point where he picked up a weapon, loaded it, a handgun, and walked into a place and started killing people?
Well, it's very important to differentiate, and I constantly get flack for this. Skinheads themselves were not racist from the get-go. The counterculture developed in the late 60s, early 70s as a reaction to the mod culture.
Okay.
Of England. And right. The original skinheads weren't racist. They were working class. They were hooligans, but they liked music from the West Indies. There was Pakistani immigrants involved. So it wasn't a racist thing until the National Front, which is an outright fascist group in England, kind of co-opted the white skinheads in the late 70s, saying, you know, the reason you don't have jobs is because of this Pakistani guy. And that's where the racist offshoot of skinheads came from.
So they gave them a way to focus their energy and turn it into hate.
Exactly. And because it's white power skinheads who, you know, are behind these unfortunate headlines and have been since the late 80s in the United States. That's why when people hear skinhead, they think racist. But it's important to point out that that's not necessarily the case. So if you see someone with a shaved head and a flight jacket and boots, that doesn't necessarily mean they're a racist.
Right.
If they have swastikas and whatnot on them, there's a giveaway. But the look itself is not inherently racist.
Right.
As far as Wade Page was concerned, and I do use his name, and the reason I do is because up until he started murdering people, he was as human as anyone else.
Right.
He was there was a time when he was a young child.
Right.
And it's important to understand that even people who commit the most hideous atrocities were human beings at some point. And the reason that's important to understand that is because if you disengage from that and you just look at them as monsters that can't be helped, then you're saying that the potential monsters out there can't be helped either.
Right.
So when I heard of the atrocity that happened at the Sikh temple, my first thought was of the families of the victims. You know, how would it feel to have your grandfather murdered because of the color of his skin and because of his religious headwear? I won't know that because I'm a white guy and my grandfather was a Lutheran who looks like every other grandpa in Wisconsin.
Right.
But my first thoughts was of the family suffering in the aftermath. And another initial thought for me was really just the magnificence of the Sikh religion and how these people who had just had their families murdered and the gun smoke was still in the air.
Right.
And they forgave the man who killed them.
Right.
And mourned his life along with the lives of people that they love.
Yeah.
And that is just, immense.
There's a huge nobility in the religion itself that's really respectable and something
absolutely
we can all learn from. Yeah.
And so I, you know, those are really powerful feelings for me that happened in the wake of this. But as far as the shooter was concerned, I didn't know anything about his background when I created my video response.
Right.
I just kind of had a feeling. Later that night, it came out that he was a white supremacist, but that was it. So that Sunday evening, I lay awake wondering if this may have been someone that I recruited.
Mm-hmm.
I knew his age was almost the right same as mine, and I recruited a lot of people back in the late 80s and early right 90s in Milwaukee. So,
and he's from the neighborhood, basically, that you were working
exactly
in.
Exactly. Right. So that was a huge concern of mine. And the next day, as his identity was revealed and his origins, which were in North Carolina, I believe, mm-hmm, and that he had come to Milwaukee fairly recently, I was able to rule out that this was someone I had personal contact with. But as more of his story was revealed, it really hit me all the more that this man was who I used to be.
Right.
He was a self-proclaimed white power skinhead who was in white power bands.
Right. You were in a band.
I was. And my I'd be very shocked if he wasn't aware of my band Centurion, and it's highly possible he was a fan up until I started speaking out against hatred.
Right.
So I felt responsibility for helping to create the environment that created him.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that almost as soon as the incident happened,
right,
just because of the hate and the violent nature of it. So when I made that video response, I really sought to, first of all, answer questions of how could someone do this, which I believe you just asked. And
right.
Maybe I should answer that question.
That's right. We wander around.
Right.
But that is a question I'm interested in, because I think, as well as taking some responsibility for having created the environment that created him, you also have the advantage of having a good deal of insight into how to not get to that point. And
Absolutely. That's
why I wanted to ask you, what happens, what gets you to that point?
What happened on August 5th in Oak Creek at the Sikh temple was the logical conclusion of a 20-year practice of hate and violence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I say a practice, it's because this is something that he did every day. His life was an ongoing practice of fear of people who were different than him.
Mm-hmm.
When you are a white supremacist, you have a fundamental view of the world that white people are different than everyone else and superior than everyone else, and at once mighty and fragile.
Mm-hmm.
So while white people are the greatest thing that ever happened on the planet Earth, we're also in this danger of being wiped out by this shadowy Jewish conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
What this breaks down to on a day-to-day basis is when you wake up in the morning, from the time you go to bed, every waking second is spent in fear. Every person you see who's not white is a threat to you.
Right.
By default,
right.
Every white person you see who isn't shouting racial slurs alongside you is a race traitor.
Okay.
And they are trying to wipe you out. Everything on TV, on the movies, music, any kind of media, the internet, it's all part of this Jewish conspiracy to wipe your people off the face of the earth, along with the police, the government,
right,
the military. I mean, the entire world is literally out to get you.
Right.
And you spend every waking moment of every day reminding yourself of this.
Right.
Now, that might include some time drinking with your buddies and playing white power music and beating people up when you're almost too drunk to walk. And that will be about as close as you get to joy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really pathetic surrogate for it.
Right.
When you practiced hate and violence, there is no room in your life for true joy.
Right.
There is no room in your heart for true love. You claim to love your race, but that's really just the root of your fear. and your hatred.
Right.
What we used to say when we were justifying the hate that we practiced was, well, we hate people because we love our race. And just as, you know, you would hate someone who would murder your wife because you love her, we hate Jews, blacks, Asians, Latinos, gays, white race traitors, blah, blah, blah. We hate all of them because they're murdering our race.
Right.
And this is the twisted logic that this is all based on.
Well, I was trying to explain to my son about fear the other day, and if you stand behind the fear was the phrase that I used, you end up picking up a stick and hitting somebody because you end up with anger or hatred.
Absolutely.
Because you have to defend yourself.
Right.
But it's hard to imagine a child growing into a man whose life, as you describe it, is consumed by hatred. That sounds like a description of insanity to me, almost. Not that that should get him off the hook for anything.
No, not at all. This is absolutely an example of personal irresponsibility.
Right.
Most people getting involved in hate groups or in fundamentalist political groups are people with an axe to grind. Something's not working out in their life.
Right.
When, you know, back in the day, we would have kids come to us who couldn't get a girlfriend, couldn't get a job, didn't have as much money as the other kids. You know, there's always something.
And there's got to be somebody to blame for that.
Right. Well, it's much easier to blame Michael Jordan for you not having a girlfriend and these black guys who are dating white girls, it's their fault that you don't have a girlfriend.
Right.
So you get angry and you practice hate and violence and you become this miserable wretch of a person. And then you go, why don't girls like me? I mean, it's really, when you look at it from the outside, it is almost comical, but from the inside, it's a absolutely miserable,
right,
pathetic way to live, and it drives people to commit the kind of atrocities that Wade Page found himself committing.
Now, this is something I want to talk to you, because I wonder if there's a relationship between then, the way you described it, there's a relationship between what Wade Page did and what the fellow in Aurora, Colorado did. I mean, they both murdered people that they didn't know.
Right.
He may have done it because he couldn't get the girl or because he wasn't doing well on his PhD or whatever. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, it's not about... It is gun violence, and there's got to be something done about the ease with which we can get a hold of guns. But it's more than that. I mean, there's something really deep.
I think the absolute common thread is that in any case of mass murder like this, the perpetrator has reached a point of isolation.
That's what I'm getting at, the exclusion of the other.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a point of disengagement from their own humanity, mm-hmm, and consequently the humanity of others around them.
Right.
So, you know, even if you're looking at the case of serial killers, it's they don't look at their victims as human.
Right.
They see themselves as existing outside of their existence. They don't share humanity.
Right.
And this brings to mind a really amazing thing I read. In the Journal Sentinel, they had a piece about that a sick gentleman had written while he was at a summer camp for the kids in his community. And this was after the shooting had happened. And he was talking to a bunch of like 9-10-year-old kids about this shooting. And many of them were surprisingly insightful and just had a very good grasp on it. But the question comes up to say, well, if God is in each one of us, how did this man who had God in him, just like we do, how was he able to come and murder people? And a little girl said, well, he had God in him just like us, but he chose not to listen to God. And that's when bad things happen.
Right.
And so I that really sums up, I think, the problem behind mass murder. And what the good news is that the practice of kindness and the practice of compassion is something that addresses that isolation.
Right.
It's as I came to terms with something I've known for many years and something I speak freely about for hours on end, about me, about Wade Page being who I used to be. Mm-hmm. I reflected on my life and thought about all the planets that aligned that took me in a different direction.
Right.
That if it wasn't for these planets aligning, I could have been Wade Page.
Right.
I could have ended up like that.
Right.
Those planets were a family that never gave up on me, the birth of an amazing, beautiful little girl, my daughter, the murder of a friend.
Right.
And I think as important as any of those other huge things was seemingly innocuous acts of kindness that were given to me by people who I had outright hostility to. People who I had claimed to hate. Mm-hmm. Black people, Jewish people, Latino people.
Something enabled you to hear those acts of kindness and to feel them.
Well, at the time of the acts, you it would be great if it was like a movie and a black guy saved me from a burning building. And I said, oh, racism's wrong, guys. And, the after-school special wound up like that. But in my case, and in most cases, it's not an immediate thing. When I experienced that kindness from people that I claimed to hate, I ran from it in terror because I had no answer for that. I'm trying to hate Jewish people. I'm trying to hate black people. Why are you being nice to me? I need to go home, start drinking heavily, and start blasting some white power music and surrounding myself around, with other racist white people and just repeating over and over again that, white people are great, everyone else sucks, and they're all trying to kill us. I had to retreat to that practice of hate and violence.
Right.
But even that practice, as diligent as it was and as destructive as it was, it couldn't erase these acts of kindness. Each act of kindness planted a seed in my heart that sprouted and grew despite my best efforts to squash them. As a seedling comes up from a forest fire, these seeds sprouted and left less and less room in my heart for the kind of hate that's required to hurt people. Now, that alone may have not changed me. My family alone may have not changed me. My daughter alone may not have.
But the accumulation of all those.
But all of these things coming together that I am incredibly fortunate for, all of those things fell into place for me. And if they didn't, I could have been Wade Page. Now, the takeaway from that is when any human being hears of an atrocity like this mass murder at the Sikh temple or like the shooting in Aurora, the first question is, what can I do about this? And I've actually, again, it was the Sikh community who set the example. There was an interview with a Sikh dentist like a day or two later. And they said to him, like, what's the problem here? And he could have very righteously said, racism's the problem.
All right.
Guns are the problem. Instead, he said, I think we can do a better job of letting the community around us know what we're about.
Who we are and what we are.
He took responsibility.
Right.
He answered with what he could do rather than who he could blame.
Right.
And it's that example that we all can follow. Guns are absolutely an issue.
Right.
It's completely a problem that people can arm themselves with weapons of mass destruction. Fortunately, Wade Page did not have a semi-automatic assault rifle, but he very easily could have.
Right.
That's certainly an issue that needs to be looked at with a common sense legislative approach. But the bottom line is, what can every individual do about this? And the answer is much more powerful than any gun control law that can be enacted. The answer is something that every single human being can start doing this second, and that's to practice unconditional kindness, especially for people who don't seem to deserve it. And by doing so, and I know this from experience, you can change the course of someone's life.
Right.
We don't know who the next Wade Page is. We don't know who the next Aurora Shooter is. But as they're at the grocery store today, or they're at work printing T-shirts or whatever they're doing.
Rather than ignore them.
Exactly.
Rather than be take out what you maybe want to take out on your spouse or something like that.
Rather than noticing something's wrong with them and distancing yourself from them is a perfectly reasonable response.
Right.
Let's be inspired by the Sikh community.
Right.
And be inspired by whatever our spiritual root is, be it Jesus or the Buddha or the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Right.
Whatever our spiritual foundation is, let's be inspired by the bravery that is inherent in that and reach out to people who are suffering and reach out to people who are hostile and aggressive.
And just to finish up, because we do have to wrap up, but the point you made earlier, which is that same point, is that to recognize that anything that goes wrong is not just somebody else's fault. We're not victims. We have to be the strong one, always.
Absolutely.
And we have to take responsibility for anything.
I was speaking to a Jewish friend after the temple shooting, and they had brought up the Jewish tradition of everyone shouldering responsibility for whatever's happening in that community. It doesn't matter that you didn't pull that trigger. You live in this world, and you're responsible for this environment. So let's start acting that way.
Right. Arnold, thanks for coming in and talking to me.
My pleasure, Mark.
On and on and on.
Absolutely.
And hopefully people will talk and talk and talk about
this. I hope
so,
too.
I don't want it to be a news story that goes away.
Absolutely.
Thank you.